Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. There's a new kid in town. Well, at least a new mayor. Charlotte City Council chooses attorney Rob Harrington. He believes not being a politician was helpful in his selection.
Not looking forward to a career in politics, I think, brings a breath of fresh air.
Meanwhile, City Council decides to bring back red light cameras while the General Assembly uses some sleight of hand and confidence in their Republican majority to override gubernatorial vetoes.
We can override any one of these that we want to.
And Senator Tom Tillis continues to find his voice in his opposition to Trump and his national intelligence nominee, Bill Pulte.
I think he's an incompetent sycophant.
And also about the administration's approach to prosecuting the alleged reflecting pool vandals.
What freaking parallel universe did I just wake up in?
And that, my friends, is just the beginning. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. Ashley Fay is with us. She's managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg is here. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
So let's start with City Council. They voted on Monday night, selecting among five candidates to replace retiring Mayor Vi Lyles. On the second ballot, they decided on Rob Harrington.
I think I provide a new face to at least the political scene. Not having had political experience and the things that come with that in the past, and not looking forward to a career in politics, I think brings a breath of fresh air. Hopefully I could come in and look at things objectively. And as I said a little bit earlier, you know, provide some leadership, some calm, some communication, some transparency, and, you know, continue the tradition that we've had in Charlotte of a really good political environment.
That's Rob Harrington speaking in advance of his selection to WCNC-TV. Alex, he was chosen on a 6-5 vote on the second ballot. Take us through what happened on Monday night.
Yeah, so they had a first round of voting where I believe Harrington got 4 votes, but they needed a majority of 6. So the runner-up in that was Carrie Cook. They then did a second ballot that resulted in a 6-5 vote, where Harrington, he gained 2 more, so he was able to take the lead over Kerry.
So Harrington has served on a lot of boards, including chairing the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Library Board. He's also the president of the North Carolina Bar Association, but he's never been in politics. And after his selection, he told reporters that he views that as a plus at this time.
I think we've got an 18-month bridge here that's really important. It is a bridge to the future. I'm excited to be a part of that bridge and to channel the great energy that you see in that room and move us forward.
Okay. Ashley, according to your reporting, some see him as the steady hand the city needs at this point in time.
Yeah, I think any one of us who covers Charlotte City Council, especially as of late, have kind of noticed, you know, it's been hard for council to kind of get on the same page about a lot of things. Meetings are going on very long time. The word chaos tends to be used a lot to kind of describe the cadence and the tenor of meetings lately. And the folks I spoke with who know Rob, you know, they hope that his background as a litigator, as a negotiator, again, that term bridge kept getting used, will help sort of bring the council together. Obviously, you know, there's still some big policy issues to deal with. And over the course of the next 18 months, I'm sure there's not going to be a shortage of things that council's going to still disagree on. But the hope from folks that I spoke with who have worked with Rob at the library on the boards, various boards he's been on, is that he can kind of serve in that sort of uniting capacity, a convening capacity, so to speak.
And Eli, this last election brought to the board, I guess, what you could describe as a new point of view, less of the Charlotte way, which is an old traditional way of doing business, and more more of a move to the left, let's call it that. So first remind us, Eli, what the Charlotte way is for those newcomers who don't understand it, and address whether or not this is a move, his selection is a move back in that direction.
So the Charlotte Way is a shorthand, maybe a little tongue-in-cheek, but also serious for the longstanding consensus of the business community and the elected officials here. You know, kind of the archetypal example is Hugh McCall, as the legend goes, looking out from his office and saying, let's put the transit center there. And boom, you know, the Uptown Transit Center is built where he points. I think Rob Harrington is a business-friendly selection. I know some council watchers were a little surprised that, you know, they went with him when there's been so much pushback against the business community this year on issues like the I-77 new toll lanes, which they voted down. But, you know, in his career, Rob Harrington has represented as an attorney large companies. You know, he's defended big banks, big food companies, Charlotte School of Law. So he's been on the business side of litigation against consumer lawsuits, against things like that. So he is seen, I think, as an establishment figure and someone who might be somewhat of a rearguard action in favor of the Charlotte Way against the newcomers.
Let me bring the two business reporters in here, Ashley and Eric Spanberg. Did they play a role? Did the business community push behind the scenes? Do you know? Is there any way of telling?
Yeah, I think there was definitely some influence in that direction. I think that this debate about the Charlotte Way maybe got a little bit skewed. I mean, yes, 77 is a clear setback for what the business community wanted. Other than that, I really can't name another issue. You could throw data centers in there, but that's kind of a bipartisan issue. Nobody wants a data center in their neighborhood. And certainly, no matter what you think of what's happened recently, the fact that you have a corporate litigator named Mayer would tend to make you think that the business community's got plenty of influence. So, and the other thing, though, going back to what Ashley was saying, the bridge builder phrase that we're all hearing, Rob Harrington not only seems eminently qualified, he seems to have a calm manner about him that will help sort of, you know, settle the roiled nature of council meetings that we've seen in the past few months. And I think part of that goes to, you had a mayor who was on her way out, maybe not always at her best during some of the more recent meetings. And so this should right the ship a bit.
Yeah, one of the things that Rob Harrington is known for in the legal community is his ability to negotiate, to be a tough negotiator and to handle the tough negotiations and kind of mediate between opposing sides. But the other candidate in this race, Ashley, the one, it was a 6-5 vote. So the 6 votes went to him, 5 votes went to Carrie Cook, who's a former vice president of the Federal Reserve here in Charlotte. She too would have brought a business outlook to this job, would she not?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of the council and their commentary and folks who spoke at the public hearing on Monday, you know, I think they're hoping that she will run for political office in the future here in Charlotte or in some other capacity. You know, she got a lot of support from folks who spoke on Monday, and, you know, she only lost the vote by one. So, you know, I do think she kind of resembles, you know, maybe more of that traditional pick for mayor that we've seen in the past. But, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if her name comes up in a future election.
Eli.
And of course, Carrie Cook has a business background, but she also has a nonprofit background, you know, founder and leader of nonprofits investing in underserved communities. So I think that's an interesting contrast there between the two finalists. I also think that when you have all this talk about building bridges and running better meetings, yes, to some degree, I think those of us who are condemned or privileged to watch Charlotte City Council meetings on a weekly basis would love to see a more organized meeting. I mean, you know, frankly, if you've watched them over the last few months, there's been so much disorder, just people saying, okay, is this motion moving? Oh no, we didn't vote on it. Wait, someone needs to second it. Oh wait, we didn't vote on it again. We need to reopen the hearing. I mean, it's just been very chaotic in a nuts and bolts sense. I don't think, though, that people necessarily want a consensus where everyone agrees and things are negotiated behind the scenes. I think there's a lot of apprehension that someone like the new mayor might bring back more of that Charlotte Way, where things you know, are a fait accompli when they come before council for a vote. I think we want robust policy debates, but in a manner that is comprehensible.
Alex, Rob Harrington has pledged not to run for re-election in 2027. That was something members of council wanted assurances from all the nominees on, but they're not bound by that promise. And in fact, our last interim mayor, Dan Clodfelder, who took over after Patrick Cannon resigned, had this to say to The Observer. He says, quote, he has a more explicit restriction on him, meaning the new mayor, about not running that I did not have. But if he changes his mind, well, he changes his mind. That's 18 months down the road. How would it be viewed if he changes his mind?
From the way he talks about it, he's been pretty adamant that he wouldn't run for mayor or city council. It seems pretty genuine from what I can tell. So, I mean, people would obviously be very upset. There's a chance that if he comes in and he mediates, as well as we're kind of all assuming he will as a lawyer, there's a chance that people could maybe say, hey, things are going really well. Maybe you should consider a run for office. And I could see that being tempting. But I think that part of the reason that he was probably appointed is because he was so clear that he was not interested in running for political office.
What are some of the issues that he's going to face as the new mayor and as the person who presides over council meetings in the next 18 months? Anybody know what's looming large?
I think the obvious big one is going to be 77 seems to be rearing its head again. And so figuring out how to direct Ed Driggs in his role as CARTPO representative, whether there is another vote about supporting the toll lanes or an alternate study or something else that I'm not thinking about, I think that's going to consume a fair amount of time once they come back in August.
So Rob Harrington,
and there's also, just wanted to mention the airport lease negotiations, which are going on for another year. The worker advocates are really pushing for that, and the SEIU folks are indicating they're going to make that a big issue.
So Rob Harrington will be sworn in next week on July the 1st. Mayor Vi Lyles officially retires the day before on June 30. We will be rudderless for 12 hours. On the same day that Mr. Harrington was chosen to succeed Vi Lyles as our mayor, a former mayor, Eddie Knox, passed away. That was on Monday. He was mayor here from 1979 to 1983. Never intended a career in politics, as I understand it. He dreamed of being a farmer, but changed direction after attending NC State and getting his law degree from Wake Forest University Law School. What else can you tell us about his time as mayor, Eli?
Well, he oversaw the city at a time of a lot of growth, and the airport was really growing from a little regional hub to more of the national prominence that it assumed. He left office and to run for governor, lost in the primary, was succeeded by Harvey Gantt, which I think indicates some of the changes that were really happening in Charlotte there at the end of the 70s and early 80s. So it was 2 terms, 4 years, but I think an important 4 years in Charlotte's history.
So Eddie Knox passed away on Monday. He was 89. In addition to selecting a mayor this week, the city council voted to bring back red light cameras. It's a pilot program that will put cameras at 10 of Charlotte's allegedly most dangerous intersections. I have 30 seconds. Which intersections, Eli?
A lot of them are on prominent roads like Central Avenue and Kilbourn, W.T. Harris and North Tryon, University City Boulevard and the 85 northbound ramp. Traffic choked intersections, places where if you just sit there, you'll see people run the red light, unfortunately.
So this is a pilot program, meaning if it works out, they'll be cropping up in other places. We're going to talk a little bit about how they're coming back, because they were here once before and we got rid of them because we couldn't afford them. How come we can afford them now? We'll talk about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. The local news roundup continues on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are here with Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News, Ashley Faze, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger, Alexandra Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. We just mentioned that red light cameras are coming back as part of a pilot program at 10 intersections around town. We had these cameras, Alex, in the past. But then when court said that a major portion of the revenue from those cameras had to go to Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, we took them out because we couldn't afford to pay for the cameras because the revenue stream was no longer sufficient. What's changed?
So basically, the city is kind of just viewing this as worth the investment at this point. The city, the program, the first, these 10 intersections, they're going to cost $600,000. They're estimating that they will get $4.5 million from that. And when they did the math, that left a funding gap of $150,000. Basically, they have money to try to reduce traffic deaths as part of their Vision Zero program. And they see installing these cameras as a preventative measure that will prevent traffic deaths. And then also just more affordable than redoing the entire intersection, which would be a good option considering that all these intersections they chose are places where there are very high collision rates.
And drivers caught running red lights by these cameras will be fined $75. That will increase to $100 if the fine isn't paid. And they expect to issue about 500 citations a month. You can do the math. With annual revenues of $4.5 million, Charlotte City Council member Dante Anderson says these cameras will cut down on rising driver and pedestrian deaths.
We'll get constant updates as it relates to the accidents, the potential reductions, and other things that we can potentially tweak as we go through this 12-month pilot.
So how will they judge the success or failure of this pilot program, Eli?
Well, I think the immediate metric will be whether crashes decline at these intersections. There are about 1,600 annual recorded crashes at these intersections. So they have a baseline to look at and say, okay, well, do these make a difference? I think the other thing is, you know, overall, not just in Charlotte, but nationwide, crashes, fatal crashes, especially pedestrian fatalities, have been rising since the mid-2000s. Charlotte discontinued its previous red light camera program in the mid-2000s, at kind of the low point for crashes when it looked like everything was trending the right way. Since, frankly, smartphones, screens in cars, and SUVs and pickup trucks now making up more than 50% of the cars on the roads, those reversals in crash deaths and those positive trends, they've just totally gone the other way. So there's a sense of urgency now that wasn't there before.
SUVs are seemingly a big problem because, first of all, you don't have the driver of SUVs does not have, they can't see what's in front of them sometimes, particularly if it's a child. They're too short to see over the hood. And when you are in a car, a sedan, you are scooped up if you're hit in the front. In an SUV, you're plowed under, and that seems to be part of the problem. There were a number of veto overrides this week in the General Assembly, and to help us understand exactly what's going up there on Jones Street, we've invited Adam Wagner to be with us for a couple of minutes. Adam is a reporter for NC Newsroom. He's been on this program before. Welcome back. Thanks for being here. These veto overrides have been on the legislative calendar every day of this short session, and yet they happened this week. Here's Republican House Speaker Destin Hall.
As everyone knows, my party has 71 members in it, meaning that if only two people on the other side are out, we can override any one of these that we want to.
And that is exactly what happened this week. Explain that, Adam.
Sure. So let's look at the bills in question really quickly here first. The three that become law right away are one, banning DEI initiatives in public schools, another, banning them at public universities, and then one that forces state law enforcement agencies to cooperate with ICE, and that would also let people who are victims of crime in so-called sanctuary cities sue those cities. There is a fourth one that started in the House, so it goes back over to the Senate now, that would ban DEI policies in state agencies. That's likely going to get a vote in the Senate and become law in pretty short order here. As you heard in the clip there, basically the way that Republicans did this, because they're one vote short of a supermajority that would let them override any veto they want to along party lines, is they basically changed the denominator. They had... So earlier Wednesday, there was a Rules Committee meeting about an elections bill Representative Carla Cunningham, now unaffiliated from Mecklenburg County, was there, as was Representative Shelley Willingham, Democrat from Edgecombe County. They both spoke about that bill. Then come Wednesday afternoon, when it was time for the voting session, they were nowhere to be found. They were not on the floor, and the veto overrides were called right away. So that means that the Republicans could just do it along party lines. So they did that.
Was that deliberate? Were those absences deliberate? Were they orchestrated?
No one can say for sure, because no one's spoken to Cunningham and Willingham. Willingham's LA told my colleague Colin Campbell that he had an appointment. Cunningham's legislative assistant said that they thought that Cunningham was in the other building, in the building where the votes were happening. And obviously, she was not on the floor. So we'll be chasing both of them around.
Because it should be pointed out that those members were both lost in their Democratic primaries this year, their respective primaries, and both did attend the Rules Committee meeting in the morning, but they didn't attend the voting session in the afternoon. They clearly knew that if they didn't attend in Congress, they would not be there, and they would not be they would take that action, the action that they took. These bills have been lying in wait for a while. Including the one you referenced a minute ago, the one banning diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in public schools, and another doing the same thing in public universities. How is this likely to affect policy, and when?
It could basically... So the argument the Democrats make is that this could affect what is taught in classrooms, that this could... Things like Black history could be taught differently. Things like Native American history could be taught differently. Republicans say that they just want basically everyone to be treated the same in classrooms. So we'll see how it works in practice. It will change also some of the changes we've already seen with things like certain centers and initiatives at universities. I imagine there will be some impacts there as well.
Another veto that they overrode will force state law enforcement agencies to cooperate with federal border patrol enforcement. Which agencies are likely to be impacted, and what is the intended outcome?
So this would be things like Highway Patrol, the SBI, potentially like alcohol and liquor enforcement. The goal is basically to have everyone be in line, be able to enforce border patrol policies. And we've seen this a little bit already on the local level. There's been mandates that sheriff's offices do this. Now it's coming to the state level. There's one important point here about the overrides too, and this bill kind of brings it up. Representative Cunningham spoke pretty vehemently against this bill and notably voted against all four of these. I believe that Representative Willingham did too. By not being there, they didn't have to flip votes. They didn't have to switch over, and both have been pretty clear that they're not going to do that. So it's sort of a sleight of hand move, but they didn't have to formally change their opinions on anything.
This bill will also bar undocumented immigrants from receiving certain state-funded public benefits, including Medicaid, housing assistance, and child care subsidies. And University of North Carolina system institutions are now banned from becoming sanctuary institutions, whatever that means. Has any of this been happening in the absence of this now unvetoed bill?
So my understanding is no. Things like the Medicaid piece you mentioned, like that's already federal law, but that's not new. It's now recodified in this legislation, but no. Wasn't already happening.
And because of the redundancy, I guess, and also because of just difference in politics, Governor Josh Stein blasted these override votes, saying the legislature should focus instead on passing the long overdue comprehensive budget. Now, months ago, legislative leaders, Dustin Hall and Phil Berger, announced a breakthrough on that budget, and yet we still don't have a budget. Where does that stand today?
Yeah, so that announcement of the agreement on teacher raises and income tax cuts and a bunch of other sort of top line things was about 6 weeks ago. Since then, budget chairs have been meeting. Apparently, they are done. We're at a point now where it's just Berger and Hall in a room for hours on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays trying to hash out this budget. And those meetings really kind of started in earnest last week. They continued this week. There were long meetings Wednesday. There were long meetings again yesterday. So apparently there's this laundry list of things that they need to figure out. That includes things like, what do we want to send more money to the Children's Hospital Project in the Triangle? Do we want to use state money or create a state mechanism for a potential MLB expansion team in Raleigh? What sort of capital projects do we want to fund? What other capital projects and where? Let's earmark that one and say that we'll all be looking to see what's coming to Carla Cunningham's district and what's coming to Shelley Willingham's district, potentially. So that's kind of where we are. It's just these two guys figuring out what's left, and maybe also, like, realistically, potentially figuring out what bills have been floating around policy-wise are going to move into the budget, because not a lot of legislation has passed this session. There's been a lot of things moving around, but not a lot becoming law.
And the state Senate is also planned to vote this week on a bill that would require more public notice for property tax increases. Here's Republican State Senator Carl Ford.
Most people have their tax bill and their mortgage, and they will tell you, they've told me, we didn't know we had a tax increase. So this is making it mandatory to notify the citizens about increases in their taxes.
So this bill would require local governments to hold public hearings before setting a property tax rate above the revenue neutral level. To the best of my knowledge, that always happens here in Mecklenburg County. Is this something that does not happen in some of these counties? Is that why there's a perceived need for this bill?
It's always happened everywhere I've lived. every budget I've...
So why the bill? Why?
So
because they seem to be really focused. They seem to be really focused all of a sudden on property taxes. There's going to be a constitutional amendment on the ballot in November over property taxes. What's going on here?
There's just a lot of energy around property taxes right now. We've all heard the affordability buzzword. Property taxes are the piece of that the General Assembly has really locked in on. A lot of this, I mean, this is in every corner of the state, but from the Senate standpoint, a lot of it is because of increases in Guilford County. And, like, the other thing with property taxes to remember is that they're largely going up because property values in North Carolina have gone up. People want to live here. People are moving here. There are revaluations, which are half of the property tax equation. Those revaluations are finding, unsurprisingly, that property tax values have gone up dramatically. Like, anyone that's bought a home in the last 5 years is keenly aware of that. So lawmakers are just kind of trying to wrap their arms around, how can we protect people that pay tax bills and are seeing these go up, versus how do we support local governments? How do we not harm local governments, basically? And that's been a really kind of tricky tightrope to walk.
So meanwhile, something unusual happened this week. In a rare move, Duke Energy Carolinas has slashed its rate hike request. This was a 2-year rate hike request. And Kendall Momann, who is the president of the Duke Energy Operations in the Carolinas, says that to his knowledge, Duke has never made a reduction of this magnitude on its own. They've always been slapped down and said, no, you can't do that. If they need the money, why are they reducing the request? And what are they doing to make it happen? And why this sudden shift?
So one thing that stood out in the testimony that Kendall filed is that she said she attended a bunch of these hearings that have been held around the state and heard a lot of frustration. And I know that your climate reporter, Zach Turner, has attended some of these. Celeste Guajardo has attended some of these for WUNC. And I think they've both heard that people do not want to see these energy bills rise as much as they're being requested. Their original request was a 14.3% increase over 2 years. it would go to a 9.3% increase. Duke says they need some of this to build out, just meet the growth that we're seeing in North Carolina. Again, this is kind of a growing pains problem. There's also the lingering sort of specter of data centers behind all of this. How much of this is being built out to serve these now extremely politically unpopular facilities? And again, we get back to the affordability argument. The other piece of this that's really important is something called return on equity, which is basically the profit that Duke can claim on things that they build. Right now, for Duke Energy Carolinas, that's 10.1%. They had asked for a 10.95%, which would be like the third highest in the country. In this updated request, they've pulled that back to 10.48%. Again, still higher than it is, but right around the national average.
So I have 90 seconds left, and I don't want to let you go before I'm going to move this up in the ranking of stories today, because you're here and you're in Raleigh, and Raleigh has just won the Carolina Hurricanes just won the Stanley Cup, and now you guys are greedy and you want a baseball team. You mentioned that in the General Assembly, they are talking about setting aside money to build a stadium to house that baseball team. Major League Baseball may be set to expand in 2029. How likely is it that Raleigh will be chosen for this?
So Raleigh is ready to throw its hat in the ring. We've seen state lawmakers, we've seen other state officials, we've seen local officials. We've now seen two billionaires, Tom Dundon and Mark Lazary, express interest in bringing a team to Raleigh. How likely are they to get it? That's up in the air. It looks like Raleigh and Nashville sort of have the two biggest.
I have 30 seconds, Adam. Would the General Assembly be as eager to set aside money if that team was earmarked for Charlotte?
I am not sure about that. I think I'll say that Phil Berger says that North Carolina is the biggest state that doesn't have a baseball team. He doesn't say that Raleigh is the biggest city that doesn't have a baseball team.
Adam Wagner from NC Newsroom, thank you for filling us in on all things Jones Street. When we come back, we'll talk about Tom Tillis. He's found his voice. We'll talk about the North Carolina Senate race and the South Carolina gubernatorial runoff as well. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo, WFAE News Senior Editor, is with us, along with Eric Spanberg, Managing Editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, Ashley Faye, Managing Editor of the Charlotte Ledger, and Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. As Donald Trump's popularity continues to decline, a number of Republicans have started to balk at some of his initiatives. In recent months, since deciding not to run for re-election, North Carolina Senior Senator Tom Tillis seems to have found a treasure trove of opinions that he's willing to give voice to. This week, he had this to say about Trump's assertions that vandals had caused damage to the algae-ridden reflecting pool. 6 people have allegedly been arrested for that, and Tillis took issue with U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia Jeanine Pirro's threat to prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law.
You're telling me, even if it proves to be true, that damaging a lining in the reflecting pool is something that Pirro wants to prosecute to the full extent of the law, if it's proven true, and yet they're releasing people who pled guilty to assaulting a police officer? What freaking parallel universe did I just wake up in?
Of course, he's referring to the full pardons granted by Trump to rioters at the Capitol on January the 6th, some of whom pled guilty, all of whom were convicted by juries of their peers. Is this just bluster, or is this something that's lighting a fire under some senators, Republican senators in Congress, Eric?
I think it's a combination. I think you can clearly see there are more Republican senators that are frustrated with Trump, openly frustrated with Trump. And, of course, with our own Senator Tom Tillis here in North Carolina, he's been living his best life for a while now since he announced his retirement. He feels completely unleashed and free to say what he wants to say. And I think those clips and others from the past week would illustrate that pretty clearly.
And we have a few of those clips, as a matter of fact. Tillis had some choice words about Bill Pulte, who was going to be Trump's nominee to be Director of National Intelligence, which would be against the law because you have to have a national intelligence experience, and he has none. He doesn't have the votes in the Senate, but he is still proposed to be the acting director.
I've staked myself out on Pulte. I think he's an incompetent sycophant and not the right person to lead DNI. And you're undermining, ultimately, what the confirmed administrator should be doing. He's going to inherit what I believe is going to be a mess left behind by Pulte and the distrust for this guy.
Tillis has also called Pulte an incendiary attack dog being put in place to target Trump's political adversaries that doesn't have a prayer of being confirmed. Those are his words. In a Truth Social post, Trump said he has asked Pulte to, quote, execute the immediate and needed downsizing of the Office of National Intelligence, which I believe has begun. I believe that was one of the first steps he took as acting director. But Senator Tillis has this warning.
If Pulte does a reduction in force the way that I've been engaged to do it before, where you do the analysis, you make sure you retain the most capable people, and you only eliminate the people whose jobs can be either automated or never should have been there, good. My guess is, based on his past experience, it's just going to be another hot, steamy pile of dough.
So how is this sudden change?
What do you say there, Mike? I'm not sure. What do you say there?
I'm not allowed to say. I can't say. But you can figure it out. How is this sudden approach, this change of approach, being viewed by voters? Are they in alignment? Is he echoing what he's hearing from constituents? What's the deal here?
Well, it's hard to say what voter sentiment is on Tom Tillis since he's not running again. It's not like there's a lot of polling going on. I do think it is reflective of, look at the poll numbers overall. Trump's numbers have fallen to record lows. There is a lot of frustration over the economy, over the dysfunction in this government. So I think it's fair to say that he is reflecting at least a significant portion of his constituents. But anyone who's MAGA, devoted to Trump is not going to like this. And that's why I say Senator Tillis, like Senator Cassidy from Louisiana and others who are not running in Congress, they feel unconstrained because they know they don't have to go back in front of the voters. There's not a primary ahead of them. And so they can say what they honestly feel. And they have a lot to pick over right now.
I'm not sure that Senator Cassidy feels as unconstrained, perhaps, as Tom Tillis, because although he had a knockdown, drag-out shouting match with the president in the chambers of Congress, he ultimately reversed his vote on a key issue this week after having that argument. Here's the question. Will realizations like Tom Tillis's filter down to the North Carolina Senate race between former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and former RNC Chair Mike Whatley, or have they already? Because recent polls by Catawba College show Cooper leading Whatley 48-34%. Eli, how meaningful is a poll like this far out from November?
Well, we're far out from November, but not that far, only about 4 months from the election now, a little more than that. So, obviously, if you look at that poll, I think there are 14% of voters said they were undecided. So, say those break 50-50 or even 10-4 for Whatley, that's not enough. So there's going to be a lot of things that happen over the next 4 months, but you've got to think this is a very concerning poll for Whatley to be down by such a large double-digit race degree in a race that was supposed to be competitive.
Meanwhile, in South Carolina's governor's race, Trump's endorsement went to both the winner and the loser in the Republican primary. Lieutenant Governor Pamela Evatt, who lost, received the endorsement, as did the winner, Attorney General Alan Wilson. Trump hedging his bets there, but Wilson still thanked him after receiving 65% of the vote.
I believe he recognized what we've been doing for the last 10 years to support the things he was trying to accomplish with his administration. But also, I think he saw the fight in our campaign, the energy in our campaign. And I think he likes a fighter. And I think that's what won him over.
Wilson says that one of his top priorities as governor will be a Doge-style review of state government.
We're going to launch the Families First Audit Initiative. That's our version of Doge. That's a complete top-bottom audit of all state government agencies. We're going to allow for public comment. We're going to let you take your government back. And then we're going to lay out a roadmap for real reform to make government more efficient, more accountable, more receptive, and better all around.
Now, you know, the news cycle moves fast, and DOGE was more than 20 minutes ago in Washington, so it's hard to remember, but what they did has been cast in an exceedingly negative light. But he wants to adopt their tactics as he runs against Democratic State Representative Jermaine Johnson. Will Wilson's approach likely resonate with Palmetto State voters, Eli?
I think given that they haven't elected a Democrat since before 2002 in South Carolina and how Republican the state is, yes, it likely will. You know, if you look at DOGE and how it polls among people of different political leanings, yes, it's unpopular overall, but it's still there's a stark partisan divide. And, you know, if you look at Republican support for the DOGE effort, it's a lot more than Democrat or independent.
So we talked a lot about this last week. We'll talk about it some more in the coming weeks, because the mystery still is shrouding what's going on with the CMS superintendent, Dr. Crystal Hill, who remains on paid leave while the school board investigates, quote, matters involving administrative and operational oversight. And to the best of our knowledge, Dr. Hill remains in the dark about precisely what they're investigating. Ashley, do we know anything more about what's going on this week than we did last week?
I have not been following this as closely as some other reporters, so maybe someone else on the panel has a better answer. But I do know the contract, you know, details came out as far as how much CMS is paying the law firm, about $275 an hour for the lawyers who are investigating her. But Eli, if you have anything else to add, feel free.
There's also a consulting firm or a PR firm that's being paid in around $400+ an hour.
Yeah, our education reporter James Farrell was reporting on that contract yesterday and really didn't have any details about what the investigation is. We learned that it's a personnel matter, which we already knew, and that the investigation dates to a start date of May 18th, which, you know, is interesting. It had people yesterday combing through calendars to see what happened May 18th, but I'm not sure how significant that date is versus kind of just a more arbitrary starting pistol for this. But it does indicate that, you know, this investigation's been going on for a little while. It is entirely personnel focused. It specifies it's not a broad review or a broad audit. It's focused on this single personnel matter of Crystal Hill.
Meanwhile, the school board this week voted on an extension of a contract for the online educational platform iReady. It was to have been a 2-year extension. The board extended it for only a year, and board members Shamaya Haynes and Cynthia Stone voted against that move. Haynes says she wants the system to consider alternatives.
I have all the confidence that just as we bought iReady and these other tools, that there is something out there, despite the convenience of it all, that we can use that won't be inadvertently misused by us, and where we're reaping the benefits of the evidence that's already gathered.
What does all that mean?
So iReady is basically a diagnostic tool. Kids are supposed to use it to kind of keep track of how they're doing in reading and math and other subjects. They take little iPad-based tests, and it's gotten wrapped up in the whole big discussion about screen time and whether kids are spending too much time on their screens. There was discussion at this board meeting about whether teachers are over-relying on iReady, whether the school system is putting too much stock in the data it returns. But then other board members pointed out, you know, the state requires this diagnostic testing to gauge where kids are. There's no way to totally eliminate it. You know, some parents want an opt-out where it's like no screens. The school staff were saying, well, we really can't do that. Also, it's 2026. Kids are going to be around screens, so we've got to do it responsibly. The solution they landed on was kind of this middle ground of, all right, we'll do this for a year instead of two, but we don't like it, and we want you to look for some alternatives. So that's kind of where we ended up.
Ashley. Yeah, you know, to Eli's point, this is kind of there's been a broader questions and concerns even from parents around the use of screens. There's a campaign called K Needs Play that's been trying to get play-based learning back into kindergarten classrooms, which this week CMS confirmed to us and I think other news outlets that they are going to be doing the pilot program next year, which is an hour of play-based learning in kindergarten classrooms. A lot of parents who have spoken about this campaign are just concerned about, you know, children so young with so much screen time in the classroom. So I think the iReady conversation that we saw at the board meeting this week is just kind of another indicator of this broader concern.
So I need some help because I'm confused, because I read the story this week about a new music venue coming to Bank of America Stadium. Charlotte City Council approved the transfer of a quarter of an acre parcel of land for this venue. That's smaller than a piece of land for a single family home. Yet they propose an 89,000 square foot 4,400 person capacity venue on that site.
It's a miracle.
It's going to be very tall and skinny. Explain this to me.
Yes, it got confusing because some of the council members were confused. This is a sliver of land that a portion of that music venue will occupy. The music venue will actually fill 2 acres at the north gate of the stadium. And this is a procedural matter that somehow turned into a big kerfuffle because council just has fun doing those kinds of things. But, Mike, the whole stadium site is 25 acres. And the city owns that. This 1/4 acre piece was not in the city's possession. NCDOT owned it and eventually gave it to city government because there just was really no value to it. Right. But before that happened, there had been discussion that Tepper Sports would buy that piece of property. And so city council became very upset that some council members perceived they could have or should have gotten value for that piece of property.
So this week, areas of the world are sweltering. It's summertime, but they're reaching the highest heat levels they've seen ever in some places. In Europe, London, Rome, cities without air conditioning, temperatures are in the mid-90s to low 100s. One city in Pakistan reported 125 degrees. We have some warmer weather heading our way for the holiday week. We should be in the mid to upper 90s this weekend, with temperatures reaching 101 by Wednesday. Not everybody in Charlotte has air conditioning, and in the face of summer heat, Mecklenburg County has been giving out free fans, but those at Tivola Senior Center were disappearing fast this week. One senior who asked us to use only her first name, Elizabeth, says a fan is her backup.
I went and got a fan because even though I have air conditioning in my home, you never know when that unit might go. And so I'm using this as a backup.
So we remain in a drought. Water restrictions remain in place. Drought's also impacting the already high price of food, and those price increases are showing up in grocery stores and at the farmers market. Eric Simpson's family's been working at the King's Drive Farmers Market since his great-grandfather started it. He says farmers are working to keep prices reasonable, but it isn't easy.
It's a lot of hard work, and we all want to get it as cheap as we can get it and sell it as cheap as we can sell it. And in times like these, we just do what we can and bear with us.
Simpson also says flowers grown in greenhouses are holding up better during the drought, but produce is facing a tougher season.
I was talking to a man yesterday in Pageland. He said if we don't get rain in the next 2 weeks, he'll skip 3 crops of cantaloupes because he just doesn't have the water to let them survive.
Now, speaking of things that didn't survive, LaMelo Ball.
He's okay. He's just not here.
Yes, a few people just spit their coffee out.
Is he driving to Minneapolis? Because that would be very dangerous. I'm just checking. I just want to know these things. Inquiring Miles. You know, given Ball's driving record, we will now more quickly achieve our Vision Zero goals. You know that, right?
Oh my goodness!
All right, I think that's all the time
Walks
we
lives.
Have. That's right. Any more? Yes. Any more of these comments, and we'll be fined by somebody somewhere. Thanks to Ashley Fahey, Alex Sands, Eric Spanberg, Eli Portillo for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.